Malcolm was sent to live in a detention home in Mason, a small town about 12 miles from Lansing. There he became, as he called it, the mascot of the couple who ran the home, a Mr. and Mrs. Swerlin. The Swerlins were clearly impressed with Malcolm's intelligence. They gave him small jobs to do around their house and eventually got him a job washing dishes in a local restaurant. But they often spoke disparagingly of niggers in front of him, as if he weren't there. The same way, Malcolm X wrote, people would talk freely in front of a pet canary. Instead of reform school, Malcolm became the first ward of the detention home ever to be placed in Mason Junior High School, where he was a top student and was even elected president of his seventh grade class, and where his history teacher was particularly fond of telling nigger jokes in Malcolm's presence. When Malcolm told his English teacher, whom he had regarded as a friend and advisor, that he'd like to be a lawyer one day, the instructor told him, "That's no realistic goal for a nigger. You're good with your hands. Why don't you plan on carpentry?" After this incident, Malcolm became increasingly withdrawn, especially from white people. He also began to get restless. During the summer of his 14th year, he visited his half-sister, Ella, in Boston. "A commanding woman," he wrote of her. "The way she sat, moved, talked, did everything, bespoke somebody who did and got exactly what she wanted." Ella had come north from Georgia with nothing, and she had worked hard and invested her savings in property. "I had never been so impressed with anybody," Malcolm noted, and he was equally impressed with the excitement of life in the big city. When he finished eighth grade at Mason Junior High, he left Michigan and moved into Ella's house in the Wambeck and Humboldt Avenue Hill section of Roxbury, Boston's largest black neighborhood. The Hill, as it was known, was considered an exclusive area where many black professionals lived, teachers, preachers, Pullman porters, bank janitors, and other members of the black community's elite. Ella told Malcolm to enjoy himself, to get to know the neighborhood, and he began to roam, late and wide, through the streets of Boston.
Bronson, who obviously didn't work anywhere, completely entranced me. I couldn't get over marveling how their hair was straight and shiny like white men's hair. Ella told me this was called a conch. I had never tasted a sip of liquor, never even smoked a cigarette, and here I saw little black children, 10 and 12 years old, shooting craps, playing cards, fighting, getting grown-ups to put a penny or a nickel on their number for them, things like that. Yep. Every night as I lay in bed, I turned these new words over in my mind. It was shocking to me that in town, especially after dark, you'd occasionally see a white girl and a Negro man strolling arm in arm along the sidewalk and mixed couples drinking in the neon-lighted bars, not slipping off to some dark corner, as in Lansing. I wanted to find a job myself to surprise Ella. One afternoon, something told me to go inside a pool room whose window I was looking through. I'd looked through that window many times. I wasn't yearning to play pool. In fact, I had never held a cue stick. But I was drawn by the sight of the cool-looking cat standing around inside, bending over the big green felt-top tables, making bets and shooting the bright-colored balls into the holes. As I stared through the window this particular afternoon, something made me decide to venture inside and talk to a dark, stubby, conked-headed fellow who racked up balls for the pool players, whom I'd heard called Shorty. One day, he had come outside and seen me standing there, and he said, "Hi, Red." So that made me figure he was friendly. As inconspicuously as I could, I slipped inside the door and around the side of the pool room, avoiding people, and on to the back where Shorty was filling an aluminum can with powder the pool players dust on their hands. "Smell country," he'd say, laughing. "Cat's legs were so long, his pants so short, his knees showed, and his head looked like a briar patch." But that afternoon, Shorty didn't let it show in his face how country I'd appeared when I told him I'd appreciate it if he'd tell me how could somebody go about getting a job like his. "If you mean racking up balls," said Shorty, "I don't know of no pool joints around here needing anybody." "You mean you just want any slave you can find?" A slave meant work, a job. He asked me what kind of work I had done. I told him that I'd washed restaurant dishes in Mason, Michigan. He nearly dropped that powder can. My homeboy, man, give me some skin. I'm from Lansing. I never told Shorty, and he never suspected that he was about 10 years older than I. He took us to be about the same age. First, I would have been embarrassed to tell him. Later, I just never bothered. Shorty had dropped out of first-year high school in Lansing, lived a while with an uncle and aunt in Detroit, and had spent the last 6 years living with his cousin in Roxbury. But when I mentioned the names of Lansing, people, and places, he remembered many, and pretty soon we sounded as if we had been raised in the same block. I could sense Shorty's genuine gladness, and I don't have to say how lucky I felt to find a friend as hip as he obviously was. "Man, this is a swinging town, if you dig it," Shorty said. "You're my homeboy. I'm going to school you to the happenings." I stood there and grinned like a fool. "You got to go anywhere now?" "Well, stick around till I get off." One thing I liked immediately about Shorty was his frankness. When I told him where I am, the Hill Negroes, but he thought a sister who gave me a pad, not charging me rent, not even running me out to find some slave, couldn't be all bad. Shorty's slave in the pool room, he said, was just to keep ends together while he learned his horn. A couple of years before, he'd hit the numbers and bought a saxophone. "Got it right here in the closet now for my lesson tonight." Shorty was taking lessons with some other studs, and he intended one day to organize his own small band. "There's a lot of bread to be made gigging right around here in Roxbury," Shorty explained to me. "I don't dig joining some big band one night and all over just to say I played with Count or Duke or somebody." I thought that was smart. I wished I had studied a horn, but I'd never been exposed to one. Through the afternoon, Shorty introduced me to players and loungers. "My homeboy," he'd say. "He's looking for a slave if you hear anything." They all said they'd look out. At 7 o'clock, when the night ball racket came on, Shorty told me he had to hurry to a saxophone lesson. But before he left, he held out to me the $6 or $7 he had collected that day in nickel and dime tips. "You got enough bread, homeboy?" I was okay, I told him. I had $2. But Shorty made me take 3 more. "A little fattening for your pocket," he said. Before we went out, he opened his saxophone case and showed me the horn. It was gleaming brass against the green velvet, an alto sax. He said, "Keep cool, homeboy, and come back tomorrow. Some of the cats will turn you up a slave."
Malcolm's first big city job was shining shoes at the Roseland State Ballroom. Besides dancers and drunks, he shined the shoes of Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Cootie Williams, Lionel Hampton, and many other famous musicians who played the Roseland. He also learned his first hustles there, setting up white customers with black whores and selling liquor and reefers on the side. Shorty showed Malcolm the wonders of buying on credit. Malcolm bought his first zoot suit, and when his hair grew long enough, Shorty decided it was time for Malcolm's first conk.
I took the little list of ingredients he had printed out for me and went to a grocery store where I got a can of Red Devil Lye, 2 eggs, and 2 medium-sized white potatoes. Then at a drugstore near the pool room, I asked for a large jar of Vaseline, a large bar of soap, a large tooth comb, and a fine tooth comb, one of those rubber hoses with a metal spray head, a rubber apron, and a pair of gloves. "Gonna lay on that first conk?" the drugstore man asked me. I proudly told him, grinning, "Right." Shorty paid $6 a week for a room in his cousin's shabby apartment. His cousin wasn't at home. "It's like the pad's mine. He spends so much time with his woman," Shorty said. "Now, you watch me." He peeled the potatoes and thin sliced them into a quart-sized mason fruit jar, then started stirring them with a wooden spoon as he gradually poured in a little over half the can of lye. "Never use a metal spoon. The lye will turn it black," he told me. A jelly-like, starchy-looking glop resulted from the lye and potatoes. And Shorty broke in the 2 eggs, stirring real fast. "Here." He made me sit down, and he tied the string of the new rubber in tightly around my neck and combed up my bush of hair. Then, from the big Vaseline jar, I took a hand for the scalp. He also thickly Vaselined my neck, ears, and forehead. "When I get to wash stinging," Shorty warned me, washing his hands and then pulling on rubber gloves and tying on his own rubber apron. You always got to remember that any Congolese eyes watered, my nose was running. I couldn't stand it any longer. I bolted to the wash basin. I was cursing Shorty with every name I could think of when he got the spray going and started soap lathering my head. He lathered and spray rinsed maybe 10 or 12 times, each time gradually closing the hot water faucet until the rinse was cold, and that helped some. You feel any stinging spots? Nah, I managed to say. My knees were trembling. Sit back down, then. I think we got it all out okay. The flame came back as Shorty, with a thick towel, started drying my conch. When Shorty let me stand up and see in the mirror, my hair hung down in limp, damp strands. My scalp still flamed, but not as badly. I could bear it. He draped the towel around my shoulders over my rubber apron and began again Vaselining my hair. I could feel him combing, straight back, first the big comb, then the fine-tooth one. Then he was using a razor very delicately on the back of my neck, then finally shaping the sideburns. My first view in the mirror blotted out the hurtin'. I'd seen some pretty conks, but when it's the first time on your own head, the transformation after a lifetime of kinks is staggering. The mirror reflected Shorty behind me. We both were grinning and sweating, and on top of my head was this thick, smooth sheen of shining red hair, real red, as straight as any white man's. How ridiculous I was! Stupid enough to stand there simply lost in admiration of my hair now looking white, reflected in the mirror in Shorty's room. I vowed that I'd never again be without a conch, and I never was for many years. This was my first really big step towards self-degradation. When I endured all that pain, literally inferior, and white people are superior, that they will even violate and mutilate their God-created bodies to try to look pretty by white standards.
Malcolm moved easily into the hip city life of the Boston ghetto. He spoke the jive, drank the liquor, smoked the reefers and cigarettes, and he learned to dance. Lindy hopping was the craze of the day, and Malcolm became a Lindy Hopping star. At 16, he acquired the ultimate black hipster status symbol, a white woman. Sophia, as he called her, it was not her real name, was vague about her background, but she was clearly well off and infatuated with black men, especially Malcolm. For months, he paraded her through the black bars and clubs. Through his sister Ella, Malcolm landed a new job selling sandwiches on the Yankee Clipper, the train that ran from Boston to New York. And in New York, he discovered Harlem, the fabulous nightlife that dwarfed what he had known in Boston, the hookers, pimps, and con artists who made up what Malcolm called the Technicolor Bazaar, that stretched along Lenox between 7th and 8th Avenues, the Apollo Theater and the Savoy Ballroom, the bar at the Braddock Hotel where the great black musicians congregated, Dizzy Gillespie, Billy Eckstein, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Dinah Washington. Malcolm dreamed of becoming part of it, and shortly after his 17th birthday, he made the move. He found a job in the center of the action as a day waiter at Small's Paradise, one of Harlem's hippest bars.
Every day in Small's Paradise Bar was fascinating to me, and from a Harlem point of view, I couldn't have been in a more educational situation. Some of the ablest of New York's black hustlers took a liking to me, and knowing that I was still green by their terms, soon began in a paternal way to straighten red out. Hold still a minute. He went over me with one of those yellow tape measures and jotted figures in his notebook. When I came to work the next afternoon, one of the bartenders handed me this 40 Thieves gang. That was the gang of organized boosters who would deliver to order in one day, COD, any kind of garment you desired. You would pay about one-third the store's price. Plainclothes detectives soon were quietly identified to me by a nod, a wink. Knowing the law in the area was elementary for the hustlers, and like them in time, I would learn to sense the presence of any police types. In late 1942... each of the military services had their civilian dress eyes and ears picking up anything of interest to them, such as hustles being used to avoid the draft, or who hadn't registered, or hustles that were being worked on servicemen. Longshoremen, or fences for them, would come into the bar selling guns, cameras, perfumes, watches, and the like, stolen from the shipping docks. These Negroes got what white longshoremen thievery left over. Merchant marine sailors often brought in foreign items, bargains, and the best marijuana cigarettes to be had were made of the ganja and kiska that merchant sailors smuggled in from Africa and Persia. In the daytime, whites were given a guarded treatment. Whites who came at night got a better reception. The several Harlem nightclubs they patronized were geared to entertain and jive the night white crowd to get their money. And with so many law agencies guarding the morals of servicemen, any of them that came in, and a lot did, were given what they asked for, and were spoken to if they spoke, and that was all, unless someone knew them as natives of Harlem. What I was learning was the Hustling Society's first rule, that you never trusted anyone outside of your own closed-mouthed circle, and that you selected with time and care before you made any intimates even among these. The bartenders would let me know which among the regular customers were mostly fronts, which really had something going, which were really in the underworld with downtown police or political connections, which really handled some money, and which were making it from day to day, which were the real gamblers, and which had just hit a little luck, and which ones never to run afoul of in any way. The latter were extremely well known about Harlem, and they were feared and respected. It was known that if upset, they would break open your head and think nothing of it. These were old-timers, not to be confused with the various hot-headed, wild young hustlers out trying to make a name for themselves for being crazy with a pistol trigger or a knife. The old heads that I'm talking about were such as Black Sammy, Bub Hewlett, King Padmore, and West Indian Archie. Most of these tough ones had worked as strong-arm men for Dutch Schultz when he had muscled into the Harlem numbers industry after white gangsters had awakened to the fortunes being made in what they had previously considered nigger pennies, and the numbers game was referred to by the white racketeers as nigger pool. Those tough Negroes' heyday had been before the big 1931 Seabury investigation that started Dutch Schultz on the way out until his career ended with his 1934 assassination. I heard stories of how they had persuaded people with lead pipes, wet cement, baseball bats, brass knuckles, fists, feet, and blackjacks. Nearly every one of them had done some time and had come back on the scene and since had worked as top runners for the biggest bankers who specialized in large bettors. There seemed to be an understanding that these Negroes and the tough black cops never clashed. I guess both knew that someone would die. They had some bad black cops in Harlem, too. The four horsemen that worked Sugar Hill, I remember the worst one had freckles. There was a tough quartet. The biggest, blackest, worst cop of them all in Harlem was the West Indian Brisbane. Negroes crossed the street to avoid him when he walked his 125th Street and 7th Avenue beat. When I was in prison, someone brought me a story that Brisbane had been shot to death by a scared, nervous young kid who hadn't been up from the South long enough to realize how bad Brisbane was. The world's most unlikely pimp was Cadillac Drake. He was shiny, bald-headed, built like a football. He used to call his huge belly the Chippy's playground. Cadillac had a string of about a dozen of the stringiest, scrawniest black and white street prostitutes in Harlem. Just about the complete opposite of Cadillac was the young, smooth, independent acting pimp, Sammy the Pimp. Sammy and I became in time each other's closest friend. Sammy was from Kentucky, was a cool, collected expert in his business, black and white women out making his living. But Sammy's women, who would come into small sometimes, Fat Pimp, we called Dollar Bill. He loved to flash his Kansas City roll, probably 50 $1 bills folded with a 20 on the inside and a $100 bill on the outside. We always wondered what Dollar Bill would do if someone ever stole his $100 cover. A man who, in his prime, could have stolen Dollar Bill's whole roll blindfolded with threadbare, comic old Few Clothes. Few Clothes had been one of the best pickpockets in Harlem back when the white people swarmed up every night in the 1920s. But then during the Depression, he had gnarled so that it made people uncomfortable to look at them. Rain, sleet, or snow, every afternoon, about 6, Few Clothes would be at Smalls, telling tall tales about the old days. And it was one of the day's rituals for one or another regular customer to ask the bartender to give him drinks. and me to feed him. My heart goes out to all of us who were in those afternoons at Smalls and acted our scene with few clothes. I wish you could have seen him, pleasantly high with drinks, take his seat with dignity, no begging, not on anybody's welfare, and open his napkin and study the day's menu that I gave him and place his order. I'd tell the cooks it was for few clothes and he'd get the best in the house. I'd go back and serve it as though he were a millionaire. Many times since, I've thought about it and what it really meant. In one sense, we were huddled in there, bonded together in seeking security and warmth and comfort from each other, and we didn't know it. All of us who might have probed space or cured cancer or built industries were instead black victims of the white man's American social system. In another sense, the tragedy of the once master pickpocket made him, for those brother old-timer hustlers, a there but for the grace of God symbol. To wolves who were still able to catch some rabbits, it had meaning permanence. Inevitably, I got a nickname that would identify me beyond any confusion with two other red-conked and well-known Reds who were around. I had met them both. In fact, later on, I'd worked with them both. One, St. Louis Red, was a professional armed robber when I was sent to New York City jewel robbery. The other was Chicago Red. We became good buddies, a nightclub comedian. I don't see any reason why old Chicago Red would mind me telling that he is Red Fox. Anyway, before long, my nickname happened. Just when, I don't know, but people, knowing I was from Michigan, would ask me what city. Since most New Yorkers had never heard of Lansing, I would say Detroit. Gradually, I began to be called Detroit Red, and it stuck. One afternoon in early 1943, before the regular 6 o'clock crowd had gathered, a black soldier sat drinking by himself at one of my tables. He must have been there an hour or more. He looked dumb and pitiful and just up from the deep south. The fourth or fifth drink I served this soldier, wiping the table, I bent over close and asked him if he wanted a woman. I knew better. It wasn't only Small's Paradise Law, it was the law of every tavern that wanted to stay in Terry. Some had lost their state or city licenses. I played right into it. He acted so grateful he even put on an extreme southern accent, and I gave him the phone number of one of my best friends among the prostitutes where I lived. But something felt wrong. I gave the fellow a half hour to get there, and then I telephoned. I didn't even bother to go back out to the bar. I just went straight to Charlie Small's office. "I just did something, Charlie," I said. "I don't know why I did it," and I told him. Charlie looked at me. "I wish you hadn't done that, Red." We both knew what he meant. When the West Indian plainclothes detective Joe Baker came in, I was with other detectives who, like Joe Baker, sometimes dropped in at Small's. Two things were in my favor. I'd never given the police any trouble, and when that black spy soldier had tried to tip me, I had waved it away, telling him I was just doing him a favor. They must have agreed that Joe Baker should just scare me. I didn't know enough to be aware that I wasn't taken to the desk and booked. Joe Baker took me back inside of the precinct building into a small room. In the next room, we could hear somebody getting whipped. "Whop! Whop!" he'd cry out. "Please! Oh, please don't beat my face! That's how I make my living!" I knew that it was some pimp. "Whop! Whop! Please! Please!" More bitter than getting fired, I was barred from Small's. I could understand. Be my friend in need. He put word on the wire for me to come over to his place. I'd never been there. His place seemed to me a small palace. Various numbers controllers, Small's regulars, had offered me jobs as a runner. But that toots. Peddling reefers, Sam and I pretty soon agreed, was the best thing. It was a run had any knack at all with people. Both Sam and I knew some merchants. Musicians also used the heavier narcotics if I later wanted to graduate to them. That would be more risky enough to make anything. I'd been around long enough either to know or to spot instinctively most regular detectives and cops, though not the narcotics people. And among the Small's veteran hustler regulars, I had a variety of potentially helpful contacts. This was important because just as Sammy could get me supplied with marijuana, a large facet of any hustler's success was knowing where he could get help when he needed it. Later that same night, I knocked at his door and gave him back his money and asked him if I could lend him some. I'd gone straight from Sammy's to a supplier he had mentioned. I got just a small amount of marijuana, and I got some of the paper to roll up my own sticks. I was able to make enough of them so that after selling them to musicians I knew at the Braddock Hotel, I could pay back Sammy and have enough profit to be in business. And those musicians, when they saw their buddy and their fan in business, my man, Crazy Red! I kept turning over my profit, increasing my supplies, and I sold these. This was a fortune to a 17-year-old Negro. I felt for the first time in my life that great feeling of free. Suddenly now, I was the peer of the other young hustlers I had admired.